Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
England in white shirts take the field with their Hungarian opponents at Wembley. 100,000 people put up the household notice as the visitors, recognised as the best side in Europe, immediately swing to the attack. Idikuti receives and he bangs it past Merrick for a goal. Hungary one up in the first 45 seconds.
Hi, welcome to another episode of The Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether at times football has kicked back or provided a means to counter those forces. This is The Political Football, and today we're going to travel both across Europe and back in time, look at the great Hungarian team of the 1950s and how politics shaped and affected their development and success and ultimately how they disappeared. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted that my good friend Stu Horsfield is co-hosting this series with me. How are you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Very good. And like I say, I know I seem to say it every week, but I'm very excited by this one because certainly the era and certainly the team, you know, as I'm sure will Peter's, hopefully some people remember, is a team we've talked about recently. But for me, it's a very mystical and magical side and topic to talk about, and to get in and around it and get in and around the topic about the team is going to be great.
Yeah, it was a team my father was just telling me about. I was born in 1956. So we obviously I sort of missed them, but I remember my father telling me about how great those cherry-shirted Hungarians were, and obviously this is a time of great political upheaval in Eastern Europe as well. So it just meshes nicely with the subject matter we deal with, mate. So who's our guest today, mate?
Guest today is Mr. David Bailey, Crystal Palace fan, born in Croydon, but has moved on to bigger and better things. That sounds awful for people who live in Croydon. But he lives in Budapest, or has lived in Budapest for nearly 20 years. The author of the Magical Magyars book that, like I say, we recently featured on the Centre Circle podcast. Utilising his incredible Hungarian language skills. He undertakes occasional translation work, various business interests, which allow him the time to pursue his writing, and he's currently researching for a biography on Matthias Arakashi, which we'll obviously all be waiting for with bated breath.
How you doing, David?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, guys. Thank you for having me on again.
Nice. Welcome back again. When we spoke about your book, which is terrific, and I plugged it relentlessly last time because it is a fantastic book to read. Not having you back to talk about the Hungarian scene and the political dimension at the time would have been a crass folly, and we don't do that sort of thing. So, great to have you back again, mate.
No, I appreciate the invite. Thank you, guys.
Okay. So just to give us a little bit of a kick-off, David, can you give us a little brief summary of the subject and the sort of context of the era?
I mean, we discussed last time about the actual football team itself, the Magical Magyars, and we discussed, if I remember rightly, we discussed how, not so much how they achieved, but what they achieved. But behind the Magical Magyars was a political backdrop of intrigue, of infighting, of backstabbing. It was a communist regime. I think most communist regimes are pretty much of the same kind. And it was a regime which as much assisted the team as became a part of the team's downfall. And I hope that's what we're here to talk about today, guys.
That's definitely what we're here to talk about.
The political
situation,
not the team itself.
Yeah. So let's just sort of dive into the pool with both feet. So obviously the era we're talking about is post-war, and the government of Hungary had switched from the Hitler-supporting fascism to communism. So was there much difference between those two vastly different, almost diametrically opposed regimes with their attitude to football and how it sort of the Hungarian football developed?
Yeah, certainly the communist regime's investment in football was greater than that of the fascists. But I think this was predominantly because the Hungarian leader for two decades from World War One until midway through the Second World War, a guy, Admiral Miklós Horthy, he was of minor aristocracy and he wasn't a follower of football, which was then, as you guys know, was a predominantly working class sport. And Horthy, he wasn't a tub thumper or a cunning propagandist in the way that Mussolini and to a lesser extent Hitler was, but he was older, he was more refined, he was dignified in his speech and manner, and this isn't to say that Horthy loathed football, he just didn't interest him, so therefore he neither wanted to utilise its propaganda value, or perhaps more so he didn't realise it existed.
Yeah,
but sure. I mean, this thing again may have been different had Hungary won the 1938 World Cup final.
Yeah.
But if I may, guys, a quick word regarding Horthy, because I mean, historically he tends to get a rough deal as the from a Hungarian perspective, they say a rough deal as a father of fascism. But in Hungary, he's kind of quietly revered here as sort of a nationalist, not a fascist, as someone who had Hungary's best interests at heart. I mean, Hungary entered World War II on the side of Hitler's Germany, and I mean, Hitler promised for Hungary's cooperation the return of lands taken from them in the end of World War One, and I mean they invested heavily in Hungary just before the beginning of the Second World War, boosting the Hungarian economy. So when Hitler asked for Hungary's military assistance, Horthy he didn't have much choice, but he didn't like Hitler. He sort of looked down upon him, and when Hungary's war dead, the numbers rose, because obviously the Hungarians were sent to fight on the Eastern Front against Russia. Horthy made plans to surrender to the Allies, but Hitler found out and then had the German forces invade Hungary. When was that? 1944. And this is about a shot being fired. And Horthy remained in power, but only at the sort of behest, I would say, of Hitler. And it was then, that the deportations of the Hungarian Jews and what the Nazis deemed as other undesirables began. And this never sat well with Horthy. He was a religious man, and he tried to put an end to deportations. Whether this is debatable, whether it was through personal sort of moral conviction or fear of later reprisal, is not known. But I mean, Hitler had him forced from power and replaced with the Arrow Cross, who were the Hungarian Nazis, and they resumed the deportations. But they only ended when the Russians invaded Hungary in 1944, the winter of 1944. And by the spring of 1945, the Soviets were in charge and they placed him in a pro-Soviet government. And almost instantly, in fact, instantly, it was role reversal. The communists who had been hunted were now the hunters, and that brought another host of problems for Hungary. But but in regards to football, and particularly in Hungary, the communists certainly invested heavier than the Horthy regime.
Yeah.
I mean, from the actual start, they seized upon football and sport. And
yeah. Sorry, guys. No, that's fine, but it's fine. I mean, it's interesting that you've sort of mentioned, and I mean, this is why we have people on, and Stu and myself, where we say, you know, these are school days for us, because we think we know a little bit about things, and we find out how much we don't know. And you mentioned about Horthy was trying to take Hungary in his own way, the Germans sort of moved in. It's not too dissimilar, I suppose, from 1956, when Hungary was trying to take its own way again, and the Soviets reinvaded, as it were. So,
yeah.
Strange how these things go around in circles. Steve? Yeah. Any thoughts, Steve?
Yeah, I suppose just a question, really, David. You know, sort of listening to you speak, and I'm quite interested because whenever we've been on these, and we've always sort of talked about either political leaders or political parties, and always been very much, whether they're interested in football or not, they've always managed to use it or manipulate it or mold it to their advantage. And I suppose I'm just wondering, historically almost, and probably away from football, what did Horthy use then in order to promote, you know, sort of Hungarian nationalism, or what did he use in order to project the nation worldwide?
I think he used a fear of communism, a fear of Bolshevism. That's what he used, because before Horthy came to power, in just after the First World War, Hungary had a communist regime for 133 days. It was known as the Red Terror. And Horthy's nationalists had seized power from the communists because the Hungarians soon tired of having a communist regime. This is just after the First World War. Guys, I'll tell you how it happened. The First World War, Hungary was on the side of Germany again. They lost. Thousands of soldiers came back from Soviet captivity who were, I couldn't say they'd been brainwashed necessarily, but they were converted to Bolshevism, and they helped the communists take power, seize power in Hungary. So it was a short regime, and Horthy, he was a nationalist, and he was at the time the highest military man they had, the nationalists had, and he was the admiral of, it's Hungary's navy, which is a bordered country on all sides, so it's a very minuscule navy. And I think he kept power with his fear of the nationalists. And Hungary was quite, I wouldn't say overly affluent under his regime, but they didn't have the dire poverty which the communists would do, the sort of situation the communists put the country in later on.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it's seriously looked at the backdrop of the politics and pre-Second World War, post-Second World War. But just to bring to get the ball out of the bag and give it a kick around a bit, for a lot of younger listeners who may not be overly familiar with the magical Magyars, and, you know, those people who haven't bought your book yet, who I'm sure will do very shortly, can you tell us a little bit about the magical Magyars? You know, who were the sort of stars and what they achieved and why they're so revered by people who love the beautiful game?
The magical Magyars were the greatest football team of their day, which was a period from the early 1950s, from 1950 to 1954. They were captained by Ferenc Puskás, even sure the younger. This is I've heard of him. I mean, as I wrote in the book, he was the Messi, the Maradona of his day. And, for a period between 1949 and 1954, they went 39 games unbeaten. They destroyed England 6-3 at Wembley in 1953, the first ever non-British team, I think I'm right in saying, to do so. And a few months later, in 1954, they beat us again, 7-1, in Budapest. And this is a time, of course, when England, we were considered one of the best football teams in the world. Are we still considered one of the best teams in the world, guys?
We'll say that.
Then we were really considered. Just now, we just consider ourselves now, but the rest of the world considers us back then. And they entered Hungary, the magical Magyars entered the 1954 World Cup final as favourites, and they got to the final, they defeated Brazil in the quarter final. And the 1950 champions Uruguay in the semi-final, and only to lose in the final to West Germany in what were continental circumstances. But I mean, I think what they're most famous for is the pass and move style of play. And I think it'd be no underestimation, guys, to say they changed the way football was played.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I couldn't agree more, Stu.
For me, it's usually one of my favourite topics is the sort of three international teams that, you know, sort of the greatest teams never to win the World Cup, and, you know, you look at Brazil 82 and that's fine, that's one, and then you look at sort of Holland 74 and then Hungary 54, and you're right that though certainly Holland and Hungary almost revolutionised the game. And because Hungary sits back a further 20 years from the Dutch side, do you think, David, that the Hungarians, unless you are a true fan of football, or you know, a reader of the game or a historian of the game, that perhaps the Hungarian side don't seem to quite get just how revolutionary they were with regards to, you know, developing the game and changing the game?
Yeah, I agree with you, Stu. I make you right. But I think that the people who would have been, I'll use a sort of term, prime of their life when the Magical Magyars were at their peak, they're either very old now or they're no longer with us. And they, of course, the Magical Magyars were at a time before football matches were broadcast regularly. And so the footage that remains of them they've got the World Cup final footage of 6-3 and 7-1, but of all their matches, it doesn't really exist. And people didn't have access to them back in the 1950s. Whereas I think with certainly the Total Football Ajax team of the 1970s, correct me if I'm right, guys, but then there was, most of their matches must have been televised. I mean, I think of people all around the, certainly in Europe, would have heard of Ajax, would have known of Ajax.
Ooh, Gary.
Yeah, definitely, mate, definitely. My hero team, yeah. Yeah, but you're right, David. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, people can't appreciate what they can't see, and, you know, reading books or, you know, historical reports of games doesn't carry the same flavour as seeing these sort of people actually perform the magic. And, you know, this was, you mentioned Puskas, and obviously there was, you know, so many other great players there, Hidiguchi, Zibor, Coxey, so many great players that perhaps so many modern football fans might not appreciate, because, as you quite rightly say, you know, they didn't see them. Before we sort of dive back into the 50s, I just want to sort of perhaps just take a little bit of more contemporary view of Hungarian football and politics. So, is there any political issues around the game currently?
There is. I mean, there is. I'm sure you're well aware, guys, that the current leader of Hungary is a guy called Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
And Orban is probably best described as a centre-right. I must add, I'm neither pro-Orban or anti-Orban. I sit on the fence, really. It's not really an interest of mine, to be honest with you. But in Hungary, I've met more pro-Orban than anti-Orban, I must say. And that being said, those that are anti-Orban are very anti-Orban. He's kind of painted the Western media as someone scheming to be an autocratic dictator, which I don't think is true, but he certainly does control large parts of the media. But again, this tends to be the media read and listened and watched by those who are likely to vote for him anyway. Pretty much is, I mean, I don't want to narrow it down, but like someone, the Sun newspaper and people who vote for the Tories, it tends to be the Daily Mirror and people who vote for Labour. So the media that Orban owns, it's already the people who are going to vote for him. But he's, I mean, I'm sure you guys know as well, he's got a sort of stance against migration from Africa and the Middle East, and it seems here rightly as wrongly as Hungary being sort of a Christian bastion against the invading hordes. But then the irony of it is that Hungary does indeed have a migration problem. That's the number of people leaving to earn more money elsewhere.
Sure.
But from my own personal experience, and Hungary is a relatively tolerant place. I mean, it's practically, from my experience, crime-free. Budapest especially so is a safe, modern, cosmopolitan city. It doesn't have any crime issues that other European major urban cities seem to have. But getting back to Viktor Orban and football, he is a rarity in a for a nation's leader that he generally likes the sport. In fact, it'd probably be fair to say he loves it. I mean, he loves it as probably us three do. And if he wasn't the leader of the country, I think he'd still, like the rest of them, be sitting in the cheap seats. But one of the contentions of his government is that over recent years, it's overseen what could be best described as a stadium building programme. I mean, off the top of my head, I can name that, like, Ferencváros, MTK, Videoton, Debrecen, Honvéd, Vasas, all have brand new stadiums. And the jewel in the crown is the newly renovated, and I must say, guys, awe-inspiring, but the new Ferenc Puskás Stadium, which is, I believe, 85,000 capacity. It opened just a fortnight ago. Hungary hosted Uruguay in a friendly. The problem is, however, that the gleaming Ferenc Puskás Stadium and possibly Ferencváros's, what's it called, the Gruparama, so it's an insurance company stadium, aside, the rest of the new stadiums have attendances which are just, they're woeful, they're just embarrassingly low. I mean, I think I'd be correct in saying that attendances at football matches, professional football matches in Hungary are current all-time low. I'll give you an example, guys. I got chatting with the father of a friend, or a friend of my wife's, really, and knowing I'm English, he brought up the subject of football, and I said he must support the local team, which is Debrecen. This is a town where my wife's from, and it's a town of, I think it's 250, it's the second biggest city in Hungary. So the population, I couldn't tell you the top of my head, guys, but it's got a football stadium, brand new football stadium, 20,000 seater, really, really good stadium. And I said to him, he must support the local team, Debrecen. He said, no, he sort of, and I know you guys don't swear on here, guys, so please forgive me this one more time. He said to me, no, why would I do that? Hungarian football is shit. That's what he said. And, you know, that's the word he used, you know what I mean? But this chap isn't alone. He's representative of a number of Hungarians I've met. And this guy must have been in his 50s, 60s, of the same view, which is, why would they pay to watch lower quality football in an empty stadium when they can sit at home in front of their TV and watch the likes of Juventus and Barcelona and the Premiership? And I'm as guilty as any of them, guys. I mean, half an hour from where I live here in Budapest must be, what, four first division teams. And I rarely go to see any of them, especially when the weather is cold. I mean, I've got the Premiership on telly. I'll watch that. Yeah. So here we have a situation of brand-new stadiums with rolling empty seats, and you're more likely to see kids in Liverpool and Barcelona tops than you are in without the local team.
Sorry, the
opponents of, while I think of it, of Auburn, they sort of say the stadium building programme is sort of his own selfish pet project. And this is quite interesting to guys, especially in his home village, or the village where he spent a lot of his childhood, a place called Felcsút in Western Hungary, population 1,500, roughly. There is now a brand new 3,800-seater stadium built by contractors who got lucrative government contracts afterwards. It's called the Pancho Stadium. Pancho was Puskás's nickname in when he played in Spain. And it's home to the Puskás Academy Football Club, which is originally a feeder club for a nearby bigger video to a nearby bigger club. But now they're a first division club in their own right. And I mean, I can see where Orban's coming from. I can see that he obviously feels that Hungarian football can recapture its glory days, or he's trying to, or at least it can standing in the world football, and that international recognition would bring international investment to the country. But in fairness, many of the renovated stadiums, they did need renovation. They were ransacked and they needed doing up. But his critics point to the homeless problem here, the situation, the schools, the hospitals, nursing homes, and that they should take precedent over football stadiums.
Yeah. So football and politics are sort of an ongoing thing throughout history. So just jumping back to the 1950s, which is obviously what we want to sort of focus on particularly. So I guess the sort of first question is, would it be difficult to talk or write or discuss the great team of the 1950s without considering the political background?
Guys, I mean, I think it'd be impossible, don't we? At least it was... I mean, if it was told about the politics, about the magical magic story about the politics, it'd be half the story. I mean, from my own point of view, I initially intended to write the magical magic with keeping politics to a minimum, but then I sort of found out that it would be probably doing injustice to the story and leave the reader with more questions than answers. I mean, And the actual regime itself is also a fascinating story in its own right, and I didn't think that the story could be told without it.
Steve?
Yeah, the story of the side is a wonderful story in itself. That, you know, the football side of it, the political backdrop that it's sort of played against is I'm not saying it's unlike any other, because, Gary, we've practically made a living out of these podcasts and looking at politics. But to me, if ever, you know, if ever, I suppose it helps with the reputation and almost the mythology around this Hungarian side. I mean, we've talked about the reasons behind that, but certainly the politics behind it almost seems to create a level of subterfuge which perhaps doesn't exist with the Dutch side or with the Brazilian side, which seem to be very, very open and very honest and almost quite brash in terms of how they portrayed, you know, how their story is portrayed to the world. But I think, you know, and you'll probably know certainly know better than I do, David, that perhaps the political backdrop behind this Hungarian side, as you said there, is a great, needs telling, but to me it almost adds a different layer to the story of this side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't remember thinking it made the story certainly more interesting, as you said, the subterfuge and the intrigue of it all, which certainly just made the magical made our story without the political backdrop. I don't think it'd be half an interesting story, half a fascinating story as it was. What I find interesting is why the communists, what their aim was. I mean, whether they were trying to, their investment in sport was for purely for the good of the nation's health, or that they could have a surplus of fit men and women in the end of another war, or to demonstrate communism's superiority, I suppose, on the world stage. I suspect it was all three, really, but I've often never quite been able to grasp why.
Can I ask? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry, Gary. Do you think this Hungarian side was almost an accidental consequence, one that was never really planned for, or certainly never planned for to the extremes that it eventually went to, in terms of, although ultimately losing a World Cup final, but in terms of success of that side, do you think it was almost a fortuitous and accidental success as to how, what the magnitude of that side actually reached?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I was asking you, David.
I think it was a matter of timing, to be honest with you, Stu. I think it was a matter of timing. I think that the communists were very lucky in the fact that the generation of Puskás, Yanukovych, Kocsis, Csibor, Grocsis, Bozsik, the list goes on, came to fruition when the communists were at the absolute peak of their power, seized power. It's interesting, really, because I had this conversation with a friend of mine recently, and I said to him about the magical Magyars wouldn't have existed without the communist regime, and he begged to differ. He said that Hungary would have been quite a pleasant place to live in, so therefore the magical Magyars would have stayed there. They wouldn't have had to leave. Kubala and the guys who left wouldn't have had to leave, because Hungary would have been affluent country to live in, and so I think the communists got lucky, to be honest with you.
I must have, like I say, it does strike me that the plan can't have been to achieve that level of success, or the plan can't have been executed almost to within an inch of its life to achieve such dominant global success, and which is why I was asking you the question, David. Like I said, you know, did you think it was fortuitous? Because that's kind of how I perceived it to be as well.
Yeah, no, it was fortuitous too.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you know even in the current situation we have now, there's a there's talks about banning Russia from the Olympic Games because of nefarious activities to give their athletes an advantage, and you know, so these things are still, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. But I'm just sort of interested in the point Stu raised there, and I guess we're into the sort of situation whether, you know, what makes a great team, is it the nature of the people that were born, was a lucky generation, that so many talents come together at one time, or is it the nurturing, because the money invested by the regime for the betterment of the image of communism had more effect. But I guess it's all, I mean, I want to believe the former, that it was sort of, you know, nature, but it's almost inconceivable that, you know, a country, a relatively small country such as Hungary, had this sort of magic generation that appeared all together and then disappeared and hasn't reappeared since. I mean, we're talking once in 100 years. We're talking 6, 7, 8, 9 years in 100 years of football. And is that could that be coincidence? Could that be just luck? Or was the communists' investment in football that you mentioned earlier, you know, had a significant effect on it?
Ah, that's a good question, Gary. So, I mean, and I'm not trying to duck it or trying to slip out of answering. It's impossible to really say, I mean, because it was sort of a culmination of everything from a football point of view. It's everything coming to fruition at the perfect time. I mean, the generation of Puskás and the others, that they, we discussed this last time, I remember on the podcast last time, that they came from a 1938 Hungary in the World Cup final. Hungary was, the coaches of Hungary were world renowned for their for the way they taught football. We had Jimmy Hogan and his MTK, and the fact that the communists from 1945 onwards were able to, for want of a better word, force these guys to stay in the country, force these guys to play together, and they went to extra lengths to ensure they were provided with the best medical care, the best training facilities. It really was a combination of everything just coming right at the right time, really. I know it's sort of an easy answer, but it's
a good answer, mate. I think that's probably an accurate description as well.
Yeah, Stu. Yeah, like we say, I mean, as I said earlier, Gary, you and I have done enough of these episodes now to want to take it just to the next stage. I'm really sorry for the questions, David, but this is what Gary and I get like when we get an expert on. We just throw all the thoughts come pouring out of our heads and mouths, and I suppose did the Communist Party and the Hungarian national team need each other in order to succeed? And I know you've talked about that, your discussion with your friend, and that the Hungarians would have succeeded without them, but did communism need this football side for legitimacy, if you like, in Hungary? And, you know, did the Hungarian side need the investment, the support, you know, the backing, the goodwill, if you like, of the communist regime in order to achieve those incredible highs that they achieved?
Yes, they did need each other, but I think the regime needed the team more than the team needed the regime. I think that any politician or certainly sports minister would have recognised, I mean, Hungary is such a small country that the fact that anyone even who detested football would have known of Puskás and Kocsis and Hidik, and these guys. Yes, to an extent, the team needed the regime, but the regime certainly needed the team more, because the fact that the team was successful, it kind of got people to attentions elsewhere. You would be nice if the fact that if the team had been woeful, I said, well, even our football team's rubbish, but the fact that they could say, oh, no, our football team's one of the best in the world, something must be going right.
Yeah.
But that's such a hard question, Stu, really. I'm not sure. I think you answered it yourself, mate, really.
I suppose I'm going to ask you another question, Alan. I'm really sorry. Like I say, I apologise, but in your opinion, again, David, do you think the team were perhaps the, if ever somebody was going to be outspoken about the communist regime, if anybody could condemn or criticise if and where appropriate, do you think at that time then that Hungarian, the national team was the only entity, be it political, sporting, or whatever, that could actually legitimately make comment about the Communist Party? Or was the Communist Party just too powerful even for the football team to be able to get away with it?
They were too powerful for them to get away with it. They just kept stum. Okay. I mean, it's the same in North Korea now. It just wasn't worth it. I don't think they've... I mean, you've got guys like the big professional footballers there. mean, they're tasty. They can look after themselves. But I mean, when people threaten people's families, and your uncle might get demoted, and your nephew might get sacked at work, and all sorts. It's just I think the whole nation was just terrified and crushed into submission, really, literally crushed into submission of just silence and just, and the football team were no different. I mean, they were sort of the communist regime almost enforced a charade upon Hungarians, that they were sort of made to make speeches, toss their caps, sing praises and to politicians, to bosses. And yet they were quietly despised. The regime was quietly despised. I mean, stuff like "Long live Stalin" and "Long live Russia," she were just empty words to people. And it was unwise not to say these. It was unwise to rebel against it. And yet, and the footballers, the general feeling was that the footballers were in the same boat. So, and all the time they were winning, few begrudged them the fact that they were the favoured ones. But once they lost in 1954, the World Cup final, then the mood changed. Then the rumours began that they'd thrown the World Cup final, that they were stooges for the regime. But in all, Hungarian history has judged the team kindly, and now they're sort of seen in a heroic light, or certainly a light that they had to do what they had to do at the time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good answer. Good answer. And I was going to ask you about whether there were the perception the public had of the players, but I think you probably addressed that now. But I want to ask you about one player who sort of escaped and went to play for Barcelona. Was Kubala who went to play for Barcelona?
Yeah, Laszlo Kubala. He was a great player. And I honestly, you guys, I'll tell you, I didn't know he was Hungarian until I started researching the book. I'd heard of him. I knew he was a Barcelona player, and I thought he was Spanish. And then before, I remember reading he was Hungarian. I thought, wow, how this happened? And he was a really interesting guy. I wrote in my book, or I put a subnote in my book, and I interviewed Julio Grocic, the Magical Magyar goalkeeper, and I actually asked him one time who was the greatest player, the better player, I should say, Puskás or Kubala. And he looked at me sort of sideways and say, hey, who's this guy asking this question? And it was Puskás, obviously, but I mean, Kubala, he, in 1949, he left Hungary. He was a Slovak Hungarian, which means that his parents were Slovakians, and he was born in Budapest, and so I think he could speak Slovak and he could speak Hungarian, and he was in between the two countries. And in 1949 he escaped to he escaped to Italy. From Italy he made his way to, he ended up at Spain, and he ended up playing for Barcelona. He ended up being a Barcelona legend. There's not a book about him in English, funny enough. There's not a book about him in English. And if I could speak Spanish, which I'm sure you do, Gary, I would research the book and do the
book.
Yeah. I'm sure, Gary, you must know more. I know of Kubala from a Hungarian perspective. But of Kubala from a Spanish perspective, I've never spoke to anyone who knows Spanish football well about Kubala. And what's he like? Is he revered over there?
He's certainly a legend, a Barcelona legend. I mean, where I sort of live on the Costa Blanca, especially at the moment the politics going on in Spain with potentially all the issue of Catalan independence, Barcelona not really sort of looked on with great favour. But Kubala, obviously, is a legend of Spanish football. And obviously, the fact that he became a refugee from Hungary, a political refugee almost. You know, one of the earliest sporting political refugees, and became such an outstanding player in Spanish football. He's such an interesting character. He's one of these guys that, you know, I've been sort of researching, writing an article about him, and so the next few weeks I might have that out as an article. But my interest was certainly piqued when I read your part about him in the book. And it's interesting that, you know, a guy, because there was so much talk about players who were, I'm talking pre-1956, pre the uprising, where players were thought to sort of tempted to go and escape and make money in Italy. And a lot of them didn't, because you mentioned about the family connections there. And there must have been a massive temptation, though, for more players to you know, fly the coop, as it were, and indulge in the money they could earn in Western Europe.
Oh, yeah, there was a massive temptation, but whether but you have to remember, guys, that they were quite well looked after in Hungary. The regime were quite savvy in the fact they made sure the players were looked after. With respect to housing, to food, to medical care. So the temptation was kind of taken away from them after Kubala. When Kubala left in 1949, there wasn't the level of success and investment in the team. But he was pretty. He got a pretty bad press in Hungary once he left. I don't think any of his family were mistreated, but he certainly was. He was certainly given a bad press once he left. You know, there's sort of accusations that he stole stuff and left, and you know, he was a thief and been kicked out. I mean, this is just sort of all rumour, but this is what the sort of things they would spread about these guys.
Yeah, it's sort of propaganda, blacking his name. It doesn't have to be true. In fact, it probably wasn't true, but I have no knowledge of it. But you can imagine that it wouldn't necessarily need to be true for it to be said. Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, it's very listening to you talk about Kubala. When I was doing the article for the Barca magazine and I was writing about the Camp Nou, and it was essentially down to Kubala's influences and performances that they actually came about with the decision to move to a third stadium and to the Camp Nou, purely on the clamour of the Barca fans to go and watch him. They absolutely adored him, and it was sellout after sellout after sellout, and it was like I say, purely on his performances and what he was doing, became the need for a bigger stadium, which like I say is now the Camp Nou. He is a fascinating character too. I mean, I got sidetracked, I suppose, writing about the various stadiums of Barcelona Football Club, but I got sidetracked with the story of this guy who had come across, and the sort of instant yet massive impact that he had on the Barcelona fans, and you know, where Barcelona played, how they played. You know, he is a fascinating character.
And guys, I've got a question myself. He was manager of the Spanish national team for a good while, wasn't he? I know the 1978 World Cup. Was he manager of the Spanish national team there?
The short answer is I do not know, mate. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to invite Stu to talk to you for a second. I'm going to look that up because
I've got a 1978 World Cup album. And I looked at it, and there was Kubala as a coach of the Spanish national team. And I mean, in these days of Wikipedia, we could look it up. But I just sort of,
you'd like to say we're the experts. like I say, for me, it was more the fascination of, like you say, this I suppose immigrant, for want of a better word, and yet the Spanish people they just adored him. They absolutely adored him. And you know, like I say, when I was researching it and writing at the time, and you know, and there was, you know, there's quotes saying that, you know, at no other time had a player generated such affection amongst the Barcelona fans. And I think they were at a stadium called Les Corts at the time, and it just couldn't contain the fans that were trying to get, but it was purely to watch him. You know, yes, it was to watch the team, but it was purely to watch him and what he was doing. And I think it's ridiculous that, you know, the membership or season ticket holders was then, you know, sort of multiplied threefold during his time at the club. It's, you know, it is an absolutely sensational story that often gets overlooked. You know, when you talk about clubs.
Yes, I mean, I did search for a biography of him in English. There is one in Hungarian, and I do believe there's one in Spanish, but I mean, I think it's quite dated. But he was, I think he was also a very nice guy, because I researched quite a lot of time. Puskás, Tibor and Kocsis went to Spain, and Kubala just went out of his way to help him. And, I mean, other players might have got a bit jealous that, oh, I'm the man around here. But he wasn't. He went out of his way to help him. And he lent Tibor money, and he actually helped Kocsis get to Barcelona. So I think not only was he a great football player, I think he was a great guy as well.
Just to sort of underscore what you said, Ladislao Caballo was manager of the Spanish national team from 1969 to 1980. interestingly,
yeah, 11 really, yeah.
Yeah, he's listed as actually being Spanish. So whether he took out Spanish nationality, I don't know. But I often have these sort of conversations, you know, on the these podcasts we do with Stu, or the ones we do with Stevie as well. And often a seed he's planted my brain to write an article. I'm definitely going to write an article about that.
This is
what these conversations do. You know, it's there's got to be a great story there. We're talking about players. I just want to sort of move on to talk about clubs, because the communist system in Hungary had a massive influence on the way the club structure was developed. Domestically, did it not?
It did. In 1950, the country was nationalised or Sovietised, or probably a better term for it, and the football clubs came under the control of trade unions, local police, coal mines, the military. And the four big clubs in Budapest, who probably are still the four biggest now, which we've got Honvéd, TEK, Újpest, Ferencváros, MTK became under the control of the secret police, Újpest became under control of the Budapest domestic police, Kispest became Honvéd, famously became Honvéd, which was under the army, and Ferencváros became under the caterers union, which was sounds quite... So we have to understand with Ferencváros that they had quite a nationalist support here in Hungary at the time, quite an anti-communist support. So the authorities went out of the way to try and weaken them, and by putting the caterers union in charge of Ferencváros and changing the name to EDUS, it kind of weakened the team during that period. But the two strongest were certainly Honvéd and MTK. Honvéd, of course, was a team of Puskás, Bozsik, Csibor, Kocsis, Krocsis, and MTK was a team of Hidekuti, Lantos, Zakarias, and they formed the Magical Magyars. But people did grumble about it, I suppose, at the time, but I think they had bigger issues to deal with, really, the club changing name. Like we do now, do we change? We grumble if they change the name of our football team, but do we grumble about the owners? Unless you're Newcastle United fans, of course, then they probably do. But you know what I mean. Like, if you've got one rich owner and he's replaced by another billionaire owner, I'm only talking from a Palace perspective here. I mean, we'd quite like Steve Parrish, but if Steve Parrish got taken over, we got taken over by a billionaire American, I don't think many of us would be complaining in the Palace, really. Or maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're probably right,
Marty. Steve? Yeah, just touching on the clubs, and this is one of my favourite questions to ask that usually we have this. With regards to sort of the clubs at the time, you know, the communist regime, did the fans use the club? There are clubs almost as a political platform that almost, not safety in numbers, but where, you know, we've had discussions before where fans would find, you know, a little bit of communal safety, if you like, to, you know, to discuss ideas or talk about politics. You know, and at the time of the communist regime, was that the same going on, in, you know, in Hungary, whereby the football stadium was seen as a place of not solace, but certainly a place of, you know, a more freedom of speech could occur.
Certainly, the period between 1945 and 1956, I don't think so. I don't think people were too scared to catcall anything, or it just wasn't worth the risk,
okay,
Stu, of shouting something out or talking out of turn. They were sort of, I say spies, but they were sort of secret police informers. Most of them coerced into being secret police informers. And I just don't... I mean, there was the odd case of Ferencváros fans yelling out, go home, communists, or sort of such like, but I don't think so. I think the pitfalls were so huge that he'd probably just keep his mouth shut and watching the football.
Yeah,
this is safe.
Yeah. I mean, there's a massive thing we need to talk about in a bit, the 1956 revolution. But before that, I want to sort of talk about some of the political figures there. You mentioned Rákosi, but Mihály Farkas and Janos Kádár as well. So there's lots of political figures of that era in the communist regime that connected to, shall we say, football. So can you give us a little bit of background about those figures, David?
Rákosi, he was the leader of Hungary from 1949 to 1953. He was, I mean, you know, when I spoke earlier of Viktor Orban, I think I called him divisive. But with Rákosi, he's not divisive. Everyone here hates him. And I've never met a Hungarian yet who's got anything good word to say about him. And I mean, I'll give you a little bit of background on the guys. He was born in Banská Rosenfeld in what is now a small village in what is now Serbia, which then belonged to Hungary. I think he was one of 13 children. His father was, he was like a provincial grocer. And they weren't poor, they weren't rich, but Rákosi, he had a photographic memory. And as an adult, he would speak what 10 languages, I think. He won a scholarship as a child to university in Budapest, and then he entered banking, worked in Germany and London. And while he was in London, it was said that there he developed his interest in politics. And then World War I broke out. He returned to Hungary, was conscripted, was captured on the Eastern Front by the Russians, converted to Bolshevism, and he was one of the guys who came back as a POW, or an ex-POW, I should say, to Budapest, took part in the Red Terror, which was the first communist government. For the crimes he committed then, he was sentenced to 15 years in prison by the Horthy regime. And in 1939, he was released with a Soviet sort of friendship pact with the Soviets. And in 1949, he was returned to Hungary as leader of the Communist Party. Now, in between that 1939-1945, he was trained in Moscow. The Russians were training him and other Hungarian communists to one day take over. And Rákosi was, I mean, they give him a bad press here in Hungary, and rightly so. He was a murderous, he was a really sort of murderous so and so. But the truth was that he survived in the world he was in. You know what I mean? He survived the Stalin purges, he survived the Horthy prisons. And he had a very interesting character. He was sort of very very pleasant, very, very, very nice to servants and chauffeurs and whatnot. But he also took a sort of gleeful enjoyment in the downfall of his comrades, people who he'd worked with, who he'd suffered with, who he'd, you know. But, I mean, really, it was sort of like a be eliminated or eliminate. And he was very good at it. But when Stalin died in 1953, by the way, Stalin hated him, guys. Stalin actually despised him. And this is the only way Rákosi could stay in power, was to constantly try and please Stalin. So whatever pleased Stalin, Rákosi would do. And in 1953, when Stalin died, Rákosi was sort of oosted out. And he spent his last days in Russia. He died there in 1971. But regarding football... I think Rákosi kept a lazy eye on it, but one of his leading henchmen was a guy called Mihály Farkas. Now he was a football lover. He was one who cultivated the friendship with the national football team. He became a friend of sorts with Puskás. And I wouldn't say Puskás liked him, but I mean. Farkas as well. You know these kind of guys that you meet in life who are threatening without having to make threats. Farkas was one of them, you know. And so Puskás sort of had to tread very carefully with him. But I mean, I wouldn't say Farkas oversaw the investment and aid into the team, but he certainly made sure they got it. He made sure the football players, had license to smuggle, and he liked basking their success. He liked it, and he generally liked football. Whether Hungarian football liked him being around is a different matter. I'm not sure they did, but he was just someone they had to deal with, and they just happened to... He just someone they had to deal with, and he was just someone who had power over life and death, really.
Yeah. Do?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you know, conversations like this put an awful lot of into perspective, and certainly as much as we all love football, and you know, football plays such a massive part in our lives, and then you look at listen to what Dave is talking about there, and all of a sudden, yes, football becomes important when you look at someone like Puskás, where staying on the right side of somebody could potentially mean the matter of life and death. And I think possibly for me, the biggest shift here is this, and I suppose of any dominant regime that you have, but it's, you know, someone like Puskás, who was so revered, so well known, so famous and so celebrated, and yet there he is trying to pacify, you know, possibly the link between politics and the Hungarian national team, the pressure to perform, and yet the pressure to maintain that balance of relationship and almost protect the team from the politicians, if you like, is something, again, that you just don't ever consider.
I don't think anyone else. I think very few people other than Puskás could have carried that off. Really, he was very, very, what was he? He was very adept at dealing with people. He kind of spoke to everyone the same, and he didn't seem overly concerned or particularly scared by people. It wasn't because he was he wasn't intimidated. I just don't think he was that clever enough. He wasn't stupid by any means, but he just wasn't that clever to be intimidated by people. He just didn't really sort of, why would this guy intimidate me on Puskás? And so anyone else would have sort of think, oh, you know, I'm dealing with this guy here, it's a power of life and death, but with Puskás. But I'm probably doing him injustice, really. He was Puskás, and he could get away with a lot more than other people could. But that's probably why, and be honest with you guys, that's probably why Farkas probably liked him, because he wasn't sycophantic.
Do you think... I'm not saying a responsibility, because that's the wrong word. You can't place this responsibility on anybody. But do you think Puskás could have been a political figure later on in life, post-football career? I know you've just sort of talked a little bit about his, you know, like you say, being very adept, a very, you know, way of communicating with everyone. And a lot of the time, that's what politics is all about, communication and how you communicate your ideas. But do you get the impression, David, that potentially there could have been a political career there for him off the back of this success through the football?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he had any interest in politics whatsoever. I think he was obsessed with football, and politics him was just something which was, you know, I mean, every 4 years he had to make his vote. I don't think so, no. I don't think he was interested in politics in any way, shape or form.
But could he have been a good politician?
No, he wasn't prepared to lie blatantly.
Okay.
No.
I like that. That's good. Great answer. I'm happy with that.
Just so, okay. So because I want to sort of before we finish, and you know, time's always our enemy on this. You know, fascinating subject. They sort of eat away at our time. But there's a couple of things I want to cover before we sort of disappear. So, firstly, obviously, the big issue is, with especially with the magical Magyars, is the 1956 revolution or uprising, if you want to categorise it. So how did those two weeks... It's interesting because it was actually literally 2 weeks after I was born, 23rd October or 24th October, I think it was, 1956. How did that construe into destroying the great Hungarian team, David?
The revolution itself, it gave people the first opportunity in 7 years to leave Hungary, because the Russians departed. And then not all the Hungarians, but a lot of Hungarians, in the hundreds of thousands, rushed to the Austrian border to leave while they could. And a lot of the football players were no different. And because at that exact time, Honvéd were drawn in a European Cup first round against Athletico Bilbao. Athletico Bilbao, yeah. And Bilbao, and So they had an opportunity to leave. And I'm not sure what the situation would have been had of that European qualifier not have taken place, whether the guys would have stayed there. Because once Puskás and Gibor and Kocsis left, they didn't really want to go back. But had they stayed in Hungary, maybe it would have been different. So that was the spine of the team, really. That was the flair of the team. They were the players who made the difference between the Magical Magyars being a very good team and a special team. And once those three guys left, it was, you know.
Yeah. Yes, Stu?
Yeah. I mean, do you think, you know, we talk, you know, Gary's knowledge is phenomenal of sort of Central European politics. You know, I know nothing in comparison to Gary, but the question, David, then is: do you think, based around this successful period and then sort of post revolution, that there will always be that this Hungarian side is never going to escape the insinuation that communism is what drove this side?
Yeah, I've never thought about that, Stu. I've never thought about that, and yeah, no, you're right. That's what they originally sort of been said. That is not their legacy, but it is a part of their legacy.
Because, I mean, again, it can be seen as fortuitous. I mean, it's not. A revolution can't be fortuitous. But in terms of timing, you know, you could look at it in black and white and say, well, while we were there, this is what happened. And then when we weren't, that's what happened. Now, the story is not that simple. But in terms of, like we say, legacy and insinuation, they are undeniable facts, if you like.
They are. Because I think the revolution was such a domineering factor of the year 1956 for the Hungarians that football was just a secondary, which just became pretty insignificant. You know, it was sort of every man for himself, and it's only looking back that history can look back upon it and say, oh, that this was the time that the Magical Magyars split up, and that was their demise. At the time, people didn't realise that Puskás wasn't going to come back. They didn't realise that he was going to go on to greater success at Real Madrid, as did Gibor and Kocsis at Barcelona. I just think it was... Stu, you know, I've asked some hard questions, mate.
All the time.
I shouldn't have thinking time. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, David, go on, mate.
Go on, Gary, go on, mate.
You know, I was going to say that, you know, I mean, it's 1956 is almost like to many people, it's like a drawing a curtain across Hungarian football. But, you know, that would be folly in some ways, because in 1966, the Hungarian team that came to England to compete in the World Cup with the likes of Albert and Benet and Sipos, they were a great team as well. And, you know, one of the best games of the tournament was the game against Brazil at Goodison Park. So it's almost like there was a late flaring of the team. And they weren't the Magical Magyars. They weren't anything of the same stature. But they still had that sort of awe about them, the cherry red shirts, and, you know, people rejoiced in them because of that. So how well were they received in Hungary compared to the Magical Magyars?
Albert was sort of seen as a guy who could bring the glory days back to Hungarian football. He was the last guy, but he, yet again, he on his bike, you know, he couldn't do it by himself. The team wasn't the Magical Magyars, and really, guys, since the Magical Magyars, the Hungarians, and I'll speak here as straightforward as I will, that they've been searching for the Magical Magyars since then, and they're not going to find them. In my lifetime, anyway. And I'm almost sure of this. And so any team which has which has come after the Magical Magyars, has always got this weight upon their shoulders of, well, they're never going to be as good. And Albert was no different. Nilashi Tibor, I remember you guys know him from the, what was that, 19, was that 1982 World Cup?
Yes.
There's another guy here for a while, Leos Ditali, who played in Italy for a while. And they had, more recently, they've had Zoltan Gera, Fulham, West Bromwich Albion. These guys all carry the weight that they're a Hungarian football player. They all carry the weight of history on their shoulders that they're sort of expected to, you know, this is quite a pride. They have a very much sense of pride, and yet they also kind of know that they're never going to reach the heights that they reached. Oh, what's that? 70 odd years ago.
Yeah.
You know.
And I guess it's almost like. It adds to the mystique, doesn't it, of that team, that, you know, because they almost, and you can't imagine now a Hungarian team emerging that would have a similar status now. So it almost adds to the mystique, the magic, you know, the mythological greatness of this team that came from nowhere and then Hungarian football disappeared again. It just makes it so much more special, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for.
It does. And guys, I have to say to you that I can't work out why. If we look at the country, I've got a list here somewhere of the countries bordering Hungary. Not a list of countries bordering Hungary, I know the countries is in bordering Hungary, but the players that they have. Now if you bear with me, guys, we've got Romania. They've got a guy, George Puskás, who plays at Reading. Now, he is ethnic Hungarian. So the Hungarians are sort of thinking, well, we've got a Puskás, he plays for Romania. And then they've got Georgi Hagi's son. And then Serbia. Now, Serbia have got Matic at Man United. They've also got players at Roma, Napoli, Ajax. Palace have got a Serbian guy, Luka. Croatia, Modric,
yeah.
Rakovic, Perisic, Mandzukic. I mean, Lovren. Austria, they have the Bayern centre-back, David Alaba, you know the guy?
Yeah.
Slovenia, I mean, I had to look this one up, though, but Slovenia, you've got Jan Oblak, who is Atletico Madrid's first-choice goalkeeper.
Exceptional goalkeeper.
Is he really, yeah? And then we have Slovakia, they've got Martin Skrtel, of course. I don't know where he is now, Skrtel, but they've got that other guy, that with the Mohican handshake, and Ukraine have got Zinchenko. Now, all these countries border Hungary. They've all got one player who plays at the very, very top. Hungary haven't got one. And I, it's not through lack of investment. It's not through lack of trying.
So it is the impossible question, David. And I think you just said that, you know, you don't know the answer. So why is that? With a country like such a rich... A rich football and history. I mean, all the countries you mentioned just. Austria had the Bundesliga team before the World Cup, before the Second World War. But Serbia, I mean, Serbia's a new country, so is Croatia, of course. But they don't have that rich history of a world dominating team that Hungary has.
No, they don't. I don't know why, Gary, mate. I really don't know why. I mean, it's sort of palpable as well, the desperation to find that guy. And then they got a young guy at the moment here called Dominik Szoboszlai, and he plays for Red Bull Salzburg in Austria. And the sort of weight upon this young guy's shoulders of leading the team, and he's okay. I mean, he's okay. If he was at Chelsea, Lampard might run him out for what's the League Cup called these days? You know. But I mean, really,
lots of young players get games for Chelsea these days.
I know. But you know what I mean, guys? And the weight upon his shoulders is a lot. And I don't know why. I mean, they're kind of desperate to find that Nedved, that Shevchenko, the one who can... I mean, see, sort of the desperation is reflected in Viktor Orban's investment, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Stu?
What's the fans' perspective on this, David? Because I'm quite interested. You know, I go back to the three sides: the Brazil, the Holland, and Hungary. And for Holland and Brazil, clearly are a whole different. They're a different entity altogether. But obviously, the Dutch sort of, you know, came close in 78. Then they had the Euros of 88. You know, and the Dutch sort of moved on from 74. And then I look at this country and how we're still convinced that we'll win the World Cup every 4 years, no matter how it is. But I'm just interested in how the Hungarian fans, in terms of realistic expectation, whether they, like you said, you don't think you'll see one in your lifetime. And I just wonder what the expectation is of the Hungarian fans as to what their expectations are long term for the national team.
It's sort of a mixture of pessimism and realism, but guys, we all know that hope springs eternal. You know, and when they go out to the stadium, they played Wales recently, and they, was it 2-0 Wales beaten in Cardiff? Yeah. And before there was, I mean, most of the guys I spoke to were sort of convinced Hungary would get beaten. It wasn't, they weren't going to beat Wales. Wales have got Bale, they've got Ramsey. You know, and I feel I'm cheering these guys up, you know. I'm saying, no, come on now. I mean, you know, they might have Bale and Ramsey, but I mean, it is pessimism, but they still turn up. I mean, when the Hungarian national team plays, the stadium is full, and they really get behind the team, and they, you know, and it's just, it's sort of pessimism mixed with eternal hope.
Just that little, you know, bit.
It's a bit like me in a nightclub in Croydon in the 1990s. You
know? Best line yet.
Yeah, I haven't been to a nightclub in Croydon, but I've been to a few in Birmingham, mate. So I think it's probably the same sort of thing. time's always our enemy on these things, you know. And this has been fascinating talking about one of the great teams of the era of football that I love, the 50s and 60s. So I just want, we always end the same question, David, so I'm going to throw this one at you, and let's see how you sort of answer it with regard to the magical Magyars and the political regime at the time. So can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? In short, is the political football inevitable?
Yeah. Now, Gary, I hear you ask this question to the other guys who come on this podcast, and I always think, I thought to myself before I came on, I'll try and get a sort of a different angle and answer. And to be honest with you, I can't, because politicians are the type of people who, wherever a crowd of X amount of thousands of people are standing, they'll be interested. And they'll try whatever way they can to use the fact that crowd is there to their advantage. But that being said, I think that these days people are too savvy to be convinced by one person's political agenda taking over a football team. I mean, you could have, like, if I give an example, take for example, Exeter City. Now, Exeter City might have, they're going to have Brexit, people pro-Brexit, they're going to have people Remainers, they're going to have Corbyn, people voting for Jeremy Corbyn, they're going to have people voting for Raj. Yet they've all got one thing in common, that is a love for Exeter City. I think the big business sponsors these days are the ones who are the ones who dictate the way the sport is going, and they're the ones with the power. And they're very conscious of things like kick racism out of football, the thing with women's football in particular, with the I can't think of the girl's name, the American girl who played the Women's World Cup. Her stance against gay football players and whatnot, and the fact that the sponsors are conscious of this gives a platform for people. But football, I mean, guys, for some reason, football doesn't seem to have this. I mean, we've got in the States, they've got, I've got the Colin Kaepernick, if I said the guy's name right?
Kaepernick.
And then we've got Gareth Thomas, the Welsh rugby guy. And yet footballers don't seem to have any sort of, well, I'm sure they do, but they don't, I don't know any who sort of are politically motivated or politically, maybe they're not bothered, maybe they're too busy playing football, maybe they're too rich. It just seems to me that they sort of, maybe they're told to keep stum by the clubs.
Yeah.
But getting back to your question, Gary, sorry, I'll go off on a tangent. Can it exist in a political
vacuum? That's good, that's good.
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've got David Cameron. What was he? Was he Aston Villa? Was he Tony Blair? Was Newcastle United? Hey? And what's Boris? Boris must support someone, though. He must pick a club, they must ask about the 92, which one he fancies.
Well, David Cameron forgot the difference between Aston Villa and West Ham.
I've done that.
Boris Johnson's got apparently that's too many kids to support to worry about. Sorry, my political mask looked a bit then. Any final thoughts, too?
Like I say, this is the right up there with one of my three favourite teams of all time, and to get to speak to somebody who knows far more and the sort of questions that have built up over perhaps 30-35 years love of football have all spilled out in an hour and 10 minutes. And I'm really sorry, David, that you were the one who copped for 35 years worth of questions, but you're the best guy for the job that I've met, so that's why you got it. And obviously, you know, you answered everyone brilliantly, and I'm a lot happier now and a lot more educated.
Now, guys, it's a great podcast. I really enjoy it, and it's a privilege to be invited on. It's a the pleasure was all mine, guys. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you for that, mate. Yeah. And I just echo what Stu said. You know, Stu and myself always say, you know, each one of these we do is like a school day, and this has been another one. And certainly talking about a team that was legendary to me, because my father always used to laud the magical Magyars, and to take to understand the political context of how they played and the background of how they played in the communist regime is just sort of, you know, filled out so much extra knowledge as well. So massive thanks for that, David.
No, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Okay. So that was the political football, looking at the magical Magyars of the 1950s and various other times as well in Hungary and the political background to that. So thank you for listening. And we have one more episode in the series of the political football to come. And at the end of that one, we'll have a little announcement to make of what's coming up after that. So thank you for listening, and look out for us again soon. Thank you, and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.